Last night, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I left you with a question. And that question was basically this. Is this thing called Adventism, the Advent message, is all that you've heard, most of you, all your life, still valid, still meaningful, still relevant to you? And most of us have grown up hearing that somewhere off there in the future, this world hits trouble big time. And a world filled with people gets frightened enough that it finally says we'll have to do what we've never done before. We're going to have to come together as a globe, as a planet. We will achieve a global consensus, even on something as basic as religion. We have to stand together, or there's a chance we die together. And for those who do not go along with the global program, it's a real risk you will be seen as a major hazard to the whole future of the human race. And so Revelation 13 suggests that in that time of crisis, the world looks at the nonconformist and says, we still want to be reasonable. We hope you'll come along with us and help us save this planet. But if you do not, we have a remedy that will perhaps bring you to your senses. We're going to cut you off from global commerce. You can't buy, you can't sell. And if that doesn't persuade you that we need you as part of an orderly new world, then with great reluctance, somewhere in the future, we're going to have to draw a line in time, after which the armed forces of this world will have permission to use lethal force. Well, that's what we've always thought Revelation 13 said. And last night, I suggested to you we've done a dry run for that very thing. We did it in the Persian Gulf in the fall of 1990-91. We've also been told that somewhere in the future there's going to be a great fusion of a big political power and a great religious force that will seek to dominate and dictate to the world, and that it will have the physical ability to enforce its will, and nobody, rich or poor, free or bond, great or small, escapes. It's global. Well, does that have any relevance to you today? Last night I suggested to you, the evidence is now very clear, that the Soviet Union, with its 30,000 nuclear devices, its 50,000 main battle tanks, and its 4 million men and women under arms, went away with hardly a shot fired. And the cause, clearly, was a coalition between the United States and the great world church. Now let's go back and reread those fascinating words by Father Malachi Martin. Close personal friend of Pope John the 23rd, Pope Paul, and an insider in the Vatican of John Paul II. Willing or not, ready or not, we are all involved in a no-holds-barred global competition about who will establish the first one-world system of government. Once the competition has been decided, the world and all that's in it, our way of life as individuals, our families, our jobs, our trade and commerce, our religions, all will have been powerfully and radically altered forever. No one can be exempted from its effects. No sector of our lives will remain untouched. It's quite evident that someone has a plan for your future. I do not think these are bad men trying to do bad things. I think they are good-meaning people trying to hold a very unstable world together. But in order to do that, they have a future planned. Your country, your future job, your flag, your religion. Now let me ask you a question. Has anybody ever called you on the phone and said, we have thoughts about changing your future job, your flag, your national identity, your religion? What do you think about this? Are you willing to go along? Anybody ever been called by anybody on the phone or received any inquiry in the mail saying, would you like us to do that to you? No, you haven't. Why? Because there's a possibility you might not agree with the program. And from what Father Martin said, it seems rather evident that there is not a whole lot of concern being given to whether you do want it to be that way or not. Now, last night we suggested that there were obstacles in the way of that dream way back in June of 1982 when President Reagan and the reigning Pope got together and decided it was time to end communism. And that obstacle, the Soviet Union, is no longer there. We suggested some other obstacles might possibly still be there, and one of them, namely, being the U.S. Constitution, which says Congress shall pass no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. We also suggested that there are perceived to be some little obstacles in the way in the person of some religious believers, and that Malachi Martin specifically mentioned Seventh-day Adventists as one of the groups that the think tanks that are pursuing this program have already identified and recognized. This morning I can think of another obstacle, perhaps even more vital than one of or two of those. And that is your mind. Because you yourself might not choose to go along with that kind of global collective program. Now, if you do not agree, then your mind becomes an obstacle just as the Soviet Union was an obstacle. And it becomes an obstacle to be neutralized. Now the question is, how would anybody neutralize the obstacle of your mind? Well, let's talk about the mind. The human mind is a majestic organ, and it has at least a couple of major facets to it. One of the areas of the human mind is like a great big cavernous warehouse. It's huge. You don't know the depth of it because you've never been to all the extremities of it. Psychologists call it the subconscious. It's a place where you put things you don't need to be using right now. The place where, for example, you store that phone number you no longer need to remember. Where you put memories that you're not real comfortable with and you'd kind of like to get rid of them. You shove them aside. They go into the subconscious. Now, psychologists tell us that what goes into the subconscious may not be remembered by you, but it still can affect your behavior. We'll talk more about that this afternoon. So there's this cavern of the mind where you put things that you may not necessarily be thinking about, but in ways you aren't aware of, they affect your behavior. That is the part of the mind that the hypnotist addresses when he says you will do such and such on the count of three, see? Now, there's another part of the mind which we're much more acquainted with day by day, and that's the conscious mind. That's the place where you decide whether you're going to do this, that, or the other thing. Whether you're going to Monterey Bay or some other school, heaven forbid. Whether you're going to class today or whether you're going to make up a good excuse. It's the part of your mind where later on you're going to decide whether you buy a Viper or a ZR1. You consciously take in information, you think about it, you pass a judgment, and you make what hopefully is a good decision. That's the conscious mind. Now, physiologically, that part of your mind is located in the very front part of your brain. Frontal lobes, right up front, right behind the forehead. That's the, so to speak, the gatehouse of your mind. That's the place where you decide what comes in and what does not. Say, by the way, what does Revelation 13 say? At the end of time, a seal is put on you someplace? Where? In the forehead. Why? Because that represents your conscious mind. That's the place where you get to say no. Now, if I wanted to get into your mind and you were saying, oh, no, you don't, what would I be apt to try to do? Well, I'd be apt to go looking for another door, wouldn't I? I'd look for a back door to your mind, another way in. Now, pray tell, how might I accomplish that? Well, let me tell you a little story. When I was a sophomore in college, somebody called me up with a kind of job offer you can't resist. I mean, it's the kind where you say, not yes, but yes, sir. How soon do you want me there? This was a radio station in Southern California, about 10 miles from where I was living. They said, we have an opening in the afternoon board shift for a new announcer. Would you like to come down and give it a try? And I mean, I was there 5 minutes before I hung the phone up. This was just a dream job for a college kid. You know, I could go there, I could get exposed to a whole new facet of life and see a world I had never before had any exposure to. So I began what ultimately was a 6-year adventure in radio broadcasting in Southern California. And over that 6 years of time, I worked at 6 different stations. I mean, the whole gamut. All the way from classical music that I swear was so deep and to me so boring, you could listen to it and have a root canal done and never wake up. We did some middle-of-the-road stuff, you know, Montavani, Ray Conniff, Doris Day, that kind of thing. By the way, I worked for a while at one station with Jim Conniff, who was a son of Ray Conniff, who at that time had a very well-known choral group going. Jim was one of those guys that even though his dad was rich and famous, he didn't want any part of it. He wanted to earn his own way. And there he was jockeying with the rest of us at an AM station in Southern California. And every once in a while, Ray would come in to see his boy. A nicer fella you never met. Just a prince of a man. Ray Conniff, one of those rare individuals that has the capacity to be not only rich and famous, but nice. It's a real nice combination. Well, along the way, I finally got what I consider to be the ultimate job. I was, probably in my early 20s by this time. Somebody called up and said, we have a job offer for you, and this is the one I had never worked before. It's one we called in the trade a rocker. I mean, top 40, rock and roll. Well, in the FM stations that I had been working in, you know, if you got calls, you maybe got 4 calls an hour from little old ladies who wanted to hear Patti Page or Doris Day. And it wasn't essentially a very stimulating type of work. You know, you could put the record on and study between records, and I studied a lot of my time through college doing that. But in this station, it was a totally different world. Out there about 200 yards from the studio were those 4 big antenna stacks that shot a signal all over Southern California. I mean, from Hollywood to Palm Springs. Totally different world. And it spread your voice everywhere. And I'd been used to a certain type of announcing, but this one was different. And I learned that people were listening to this stuff. When you open the mic on that one, on the mighty 590, the sound of music for all of Southern California, I'm taking requests at 737-4400. By the time you turn the mic off, clickety-clickety-click, those phone lines are lighting up. Why? We were getting to people, and they weren't the little old ladies. The ones we were reaching were the kids in high school. Well, I began wondering, what is the difference? How am I reaching the audience so powerfully now when I never did before? And it finally came to me the kind of music we were playing was getting to people, and I mean getting to them good. Well, a few months went by, and a new rock group came on the scene. They were kind of strange-looking characters. They wore suits and ties, but they had long hair. And they called themselves the Beatles. And one day, the program director came into the announcer's lounge, and he said, yeah, I got an idea. Now, these guys are getting kind of big. Ed Sullivan's just had them on nationwide TV. They have never been to the west coast of the United States. What do you say we bring them? Let's have our station sponsor this group to the Hollywood Bowl. Well, everybody thought it was a good idea, and so arrangements were made with their booking agent to get them here. And to make a long story short, the promotional materials began to arrive. We jocks got these little packages of black and white prints of this new group called the Beatles. And our job was go out and begin to publicize this stuff in the community. We would go out to schools and so forth. And have you ever been mobbed by a pack of 8th graders? It's a unique experience. You know, you're on campus, you have instant credibility because you're a disc jockey, and you're handing out pictures of a rock group. Now, we did a contest, and kids from all over the Inland Empire got to ride on the buses into the Hollywood Bowl, and we saw something happen there that I've never forgotten. Now, I've always had a profound respect for the young mind. There's no mind clearer than the teenage mind. And to the teenagers here, I just beg of you, don't get old. It's a bummer. Don't do it. Don't grow old getting old. Keep that clear sense of what's real and what isn't, because a lot of older people lose it, and they lose it by compromising with truth. Well, in we go into this concert, and all of a sudden, this crowd of kids that I had always assumed to be the brightest minds in town are suddenly reduced to one mindless, swaying blob. They aren't thinking anymore, not for themselves. They are one collective mind, and they're now reacting. They're not proacting. You know, there's a difference between being reactive and proactive. There's a difference between those who get things done and those who watch things get done. Well, I began wondering, what was happening to those kids? It didn't bother me at the time. I wasn't a little old lady. I was a disc jockey. I was pumping this stuff all over Southern California all the time. Didn't bother me, but it still raised a question in my mind. What was happening? I wouldn't really understand that until I became a lawyer. By the way, one day on a board shift, I finally decided I was going to do that because I was sensationally bored. Just bored to death. I had heard the song 100 times. I was tired of talking to the little gal who had called in on line 3. By the way, do you know how to terminate a telephone conversation with apparent innocence? You get in the middle of a sentence, keep talking, and you push the button down while you're talking. See, they'll think that something went wrong with the line. So I got off the line with that little gal, and I sat there thinking, you know, the guy that owns this station is a lawyer. What, Walton, pray tell, are you doing here? Bored to death. So I went to law school. I didn't give up my radio quite yet. Then I jocked down in the San Diego market for another couple of years. And finally, one day, as time took its course, I found myself in the courtroom. Again, a very different experience and a different view of life. And suddenly I realized, as I was trying a case, that those old codgers in the jury box could be manipulated. I went in there thinking that truth could stand on its own. You bring the witnesses in, you provide the evidence in those minds that God gave us that are supposed to know right from wrong, could see truth, react to it, and stand for it. And I look back in the back row, and juror number 8 is taking in all the evidence we're putting in, but as soon as an emotional argument is introduced that has nothing to do with anything, he folds up like a 98-cent card table. I can't count on him. Juror number 2 up in the front row is obviously not with any of us. He's still watching a rerun of last night's fight with his wife. Useless to the purpose of determining what truth is. And I thought to myself, what I need instead of those 12 people in that box are 12 teenagers. Number 1, I can count on their being awake. Number 2, they still know what truth is. Number 3, they're not going to compromise with it. And then my mind went back to the Beatles rock concert at the Hollywood Bowl, and I said to myself, Not them I don't want. Not that group. Something had gone wrong. Well, I got kind of curious about that. How can you take the best mind in the world and turn it into something that isn't even as good as those old fogies in the jury box? So I got to doing a little bit of research because I was concerned about it. Something has to be happening there. And I discovered that what I had been spreading over Southern California in the form of music has a power to affect the mind in ways I didn't even think about when I turned those records on. Now, I'm going to do something a lot of people would tell me I don't dare do in front of a relatively young audience. I'm going to give you some data because I think you can handle it. And I think it's something that you just might find useful as you play with your own futures. So let me give you some information. Some researchers have done studies on the effect of music on the human mind. And they've discovered things that are really totally beyond anything I thought its effect could possibly be. They've discovered that music is perceived through a part of the mind that bypasses the frontal lobes. In other words, there is a back door into the brain. Now let me read it to you, just a few phrases from the guys who did this research, and see if maybe it explains why those kids in the Hollywood Bowl were not the same kids I wanted in a jury box. I'm quoting, "Music, which does not depend upon the master brain to gain entrance into the organism, can still arouse by way of the thalamus." Now the thalamus is the relay station of emotion, sensation, and feeling. You don't think with it, you just react with it, see? They go on to say that once a stimulus has been able to reach the thalamus, the master brain is automatically invaded. Now, what are we saying here? There is indeed a back door into your head. Now, from these studies that have been going on for about 30, 40 years, some conclusions have been drawn. I'm going to share them with you just because I think you might find them valuable to know. Number 1, music is perceived and enjoyed without necessarily being interpreted by the part of your brain you think with. Now, you think that through, and I think it'll come pretty clear to you. A lot of times you'll be listening to music, you won't even be aware it's on. It kind of drifts in and out, but it's getting into your head. Point number two. Response to music is measurable even though the listener is not giving conscious attention to it. You ever get in an elevator and you hear this stuff coming out of the canned music system, Muzak, and it's programmed specifically to create a different mood every different section of the day. Matter of fact, one station I worked at, I had to babysit the Muzak machine that was piping this canned music into all the businesses in town. In the morning, they want something kind of light, kind of exciting. In the afternoon, it's a different mood. The whole point of that is to put you in a particular mood at a particular moment. Well, point number three. There is evidence that music can bring about mood changes by affecting body chemistry and electrolyte balance. Now, what in the world does that mean? The electrolytes in your system are those things like salt and a lot of other elements like that and compounds that profoundly affect whether you're well or sick. Now, my wife's a surgeon. I've often heard her concern post-surgically whether a patient's electrolytes were right. If they get out of balance, you got a very sick patient very fast. Now, these people are saying that clinically you can demonstrate that music will affect even the electrolyte balance in the human body. Now, that leads us to point number four. By lowering the level of sensory perception, music heightens the responses to color, touch, and other sensory perceptions. That's why when Hollywood shows John Wayne riding triumphantly into the sunset, they got this dynamite musical score behind him. The visual picture you see is intensified by what's gone in your ears in the form of music. Point number five. It's been demonstrated that music affects changes in muscular energy and promotes or inhibits bodily movement. Well, I don't think we need to have that proved to us, you know. Just go to a rock group or a dance and you will see that music, in fact, promotes bodily movement. Number six. This is the one that kind of concerns me. Highly repetitive rhythmic music has a hypnotic effect. Now, the hypnotist is trying to get to what part of your head? The subconscious. They want to put behavior in there that you don't consciously evaluate, that you pass no judgment on, but that you will act on later in response to their command. What have you become? You've become their property. Music, apparently, particularly a highly repetitive rhythm, has that effect. Believe me, folks, I have seen it back when I used to do this kind of thing. And finally, number seven, the sense of hearing has a greater effect on the autonomic nervous system than any of the other senses. So I did a little bit of research and I discovered that in fact there was a reason why those good brains that we bust to the Hollywood Bowl suddenly weren't good for much of anything except applauding George and Ringo, the rest of them. And when the concert was over, those four Beatles got off the stage and ran, physically ran to their car. One of them, I forget whether it was Lennon or McCartney, bumped his head severely on the overhead part of the door. He's trying to get in the seat because these kids were coming after him. I mean, they wanted a piece of them, you know. And the Beatles got in their car, one of them with a good goose egg on his head, and sped out of there because the effect that they had implanted in the minds of these kids wasn't going away very quick. Well now, if I wanted to change you, if I wanted to get inside your head and make you into something that you don't necessarily agree with, but that I want to do with you, then probably the first thing I would think about using would be music. I'd probably use a dominant beat to affect the non-thinking part of your brain. I'd try to get to the thalamus, that part that controls your muscles with the brain turned off. I'd use lots of sensory input to overload your conscious mind. And then when your conscious mind is maxed out with this stuff, I'd insert my message. And you know what I'd do? I'd probably try to put it in the lyrics. Now, if what I was trying to say to you wasn't too gross, I'd just put it right in the lyrics. If it was too gross to be heard in plain English, you know what I would do? I would reverse it, backmask it on the other track of the master recording, and you'd hear it backwards. Now, can the mind perceive stuff that's said backwards? Well, let me give you just a little experiment to try. When you get some time today, tomorrow, whenever, go to your dorm room, hold up a book to a mirror, and see if you can read it. Now, you won't read it fast, but you'll get it. You can read it. As a matter of fact, I knew a guy in a recording studio one time that had been, you know, splicing and editing tapes, and he had run them forwards and backwards so many times he could talk backwards. Could do it easy. Didn't make any sense to us, but I suppose, you know, you could still perceive what's going in there. And us disc jockeys, you know, the way we would cue a record on the turntable is you turn it by hand until you hear a squawk from the needle and you back it off just as far as you need to so that that turntable's up to speed by the time the music starts because you want everything tight. When you turn the mic off, you got to have sound the next instant on a top 40 station. So we'd cue this stuff and you would cue it forward and backwards, and if the opening of that record is words, you're going to hear them forward, you're going to hear them backwards, and pretty soon you're sensing you can perceive stuff backwards as well as forwards. Now, in our recording studios, in our broadcast editing studios where we did commercials, when we analyzed this stuff, just for fun, somebody backmasked one of those early tapes. And guess what you're hearing on the other track? My sweet Satan. If I wanted to get to you, I probably would use something as basic and simple as music and insert the message I want to reach you with. Well, what does that leave you with? It leaves you with a decision to make. Do you, in fact, want to become the tool of somebody else, or do you want to be yourself? Because there's a big difference. Now, as we close, let me suggest there's one other way I might try to reach you if, perchance, you weren't into music. I might hope you're into entertainment. Let's talk just real quickly about commercial television. You know, television has only one role. There is only one reason that tube exists, and that's to separate you from your money. Everything else, the entertainment, the sports, the news, everything is frosting on the cake. The reason for that box is to get you to do something. Well, TV has an awesome array of ways to get into your head. Watch it, and you will notice that every 3 to 5 seconds, the scenes change. You never watch anything very long. Now, in the trade, these are called technical events. You've got laps, dissolves, zooms, fades. All these different ways of looking at the same object are happening very, very fast. Watch, the next time you watch TV, especially notice the commercials. Many times, they'll only give you about a half a second view of something. The information just keeps pumping at you. Why? Because they're wanting to overload your conscious mind and embed a suggestion in your subconscious. And we've learned psychologically that the conscious mind can only handle up to about 7 things at once. When you get more than 7 pieces of data coming in the conscious avenues of the mind, you go into overload, and the subconscious has to pick up the load, and if I can overload you and then send my message in the subconscious route, I can very well manipulate you in ways you're not even aware of. So you have a rapid sequencing of scenes, new views, new information. You're just flooded with information. You could never duplicate that flow of information in real life. So one thing that concerns me about this is it gives somebody the option of trying to manipulate you. One other point that I want to raise that is of concern to me, and that is this. When you see that artificially stimulating a view of life, suddenly the real world isn't as exciting as it used to be. Try it sometimes. Watch a couple of hours of TV. Turn it off and see if the old dorm room looks as good to you as it used to. Now, it maybe never looked real good, huh? But artificially stimulating information flow has a way of making the real world seem less attractive. This afternoon we'll talk about it. Let's just mention right now that if, for example, you watch Tom Cruise walk across the roof of an aircraft carrier, strap on an F-14 Delta, give his signal that he's ready to go, give the ritual salute, and then get shot off of that thing. In the space that you will have watched that brief sequence of events, you will have seen a lot of different views. You're going to see Tom Cruise, possibly from deck level. You're going to next be looking up the tailpipes of his F-14 as he lights the burners, and you got 20 feet of flame coming out the back end. Then you're looking right up the nose of that thing as it rockets off the deck. And in a few seconds of time, you can see a reality that seems to be so great, you say, hey, I gotta have a piece of that. I mean, what I'm doing now isn't fun, but that looks like fun. So you go to flight school, you get on one of those bird farms, and you discover that life isn't nearly as much fun from inside the cockpit as it looks like from a theater seat watching all this stuff happen in artificially accelerated time. And pretty soon what you're thinking about is getting back home to mom's cooking, believe it or not. What you're seeing, in other words, isn't real. It isn't life. Now, I'm not saying that Father Martin and good Pope John Paul II and anybody else who agrees with him are using rock music to wreck your mind or reaching you through television. I'm just saying that these technologies exist. And that when you decide to be somebody other than yourself or to let somebody else manipulate your mind, you have set in motion a train of circumstances that makes you more ready in the future to say, hey, what I am isn't important. I'll go along with the group. That's where I think the problem comes. Because somewhere in the future, the group's going to be wrong and you're going to be right and you better know it. Now let's close, shall we? Willing or not, ready or not, we are all involved in a no-holds-barred global competition about who will establish the first one-world system of government. Once the competition has been decided, the world and all that's in it, our way of life, our trade and commerce, our religions, even our national identity will have been powerfully altered forever. No one can be exempted from its effects. No sector of our lives will remain untouched. Now, the question I have for you, young people, this morning is this. Are you going to let them do it? Shall we pray? Heavenly Father, we face the future not afraid, but confident. Because we know that for every problem there is a solution. Help us to be intelligent students of the Word. And help us above all to be ourselves, the persons you've made us to be. In Jesus' name, amen.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright 2009, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.